Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Assalamu alaikum.
Good Monday morning. How are you?
I'm good. You're whispering to us. How's your voice?
I'm not trying to whisper. It's getting there. Doing what I can. How are you? How are you this morning?
Having a few little health challenges, but we're not going to let that stop us. We're going to keep on going because there's so much happening in the world today. We can't give up. We can't stop now. That's what Imam Muhammad told us many years ago. We can't stop now.
Yes, ma'am. And complaining won't get anything done.
And you won't get a thing done. That's for sure. But, you know, we did have Mother's Day yesterday, and there were many happy messages shared with the mothers and Study Al-Islam. I don't know how many of our audience members listened to that program on Sunday mornings. But they, Sister Citra, I've got to take my hijab off to Sister Citra. She outdid herself again this time. The program that they had on Mother's Day and the advice from the different panels that she had was absolutely outstanding and really inspirational. And I would encourage folks to go to the Study Al Islam website to gain access to their weekly newsletter, where, and in that newsletter, they do repeat the broadcast of the previous week. And if you can get an opportunity to listen to that program, so much valuable information was shared. Really, you know, we talk about faith into action as part of our mission with this program, and there was so much concrete and valuable information that was shared, practical information that was shared on that program yesterday to make our community stronger and better. It was just very inspirational. So, when we see good work like that, we just have to keep on going.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I do. Yeah. What else is going on in the world?
Ooh, there's so much going on. You know, I was in to lead a discussion today. What do we do in this chaotic world? What can we do to bring about changes, you know? And I think one thing that is very, very important is to be very careful of the diet that we take on, of what we listen to or look at, because there is just so much out in the environment. You know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had a newspaper article. This was not necessarily the exact title, but it was, the theme of it was the final battle in the sky. And I remember doing a part of his early ministry, Imam Muhammad, asking us that question of what can we get to gain knowledge from that title of that newspaper article. And he spoke, now this was probably between 75 and 77, maybe, when he gave a lecture and he talked about this. So we're talking about almost 50 years ago, of him saying that that final battle in the sky is talking about that battle of ideas. It's talking about that battle of words that are being thrown at us, that battle of concepts and trends, cultural trends that are being implemented, not haphazardly, but by those who are opposed to the new world, the change that Allah is bringing about in this society. And so I think we have to be very, very careful of what are our sources of information, and to vary, you know, where we're getting information, what we're looking at, what we're reading, so that we can get a fuller picture of what's going on now. You know, just one random thought that I've had a couple of days, and I was discussing this, I think it was Saturday, with Dr. Garrett, who I hope to have on in June, talking about activism. You know, we've had him on previously because he was one of the founding members and key activists with the establishment of the Black Studies Department at San Francisco State. But we were talking and, you know, I was saying it's a shame that with all that is going on in the world today and the actions we see being taken by young people on one hand on the various campuses here in America, but throughout the world. I mean, you know, Canada, Brussels, Mexico, you know, student activists have set up encampments demanding divestment from the companies that are profiteering off of war and just a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire. You know, you see all of this activity going on in the world by different coalitions of Muslim voices, Arab voices, Palestinian voices, Jewish voices, you know, Jewish voices for peace. One very influential group that does all kinds of civil disobedient activities are Code Pink from out here in the Bay Area. Well, they're all throughout the country, but I don't know if she's still in the Bay Area, but Madea Benjamin has been the head of that organization a good 30, I think it must be at least 30 plus years. But anyway, you see all of this going on. And the main thing that we know that Imam Muhammad spoke to us and taught us about the four birds as far as education, governance, economic development, cultural development. Now here's the main thing that they're promoting in our community when we need to have the young people in our community attuned to the important political and social issues going on. The main thing that they're thrusting about in our community, the trend, if you were to see a trend line, is the beef between Drake and Kendrick Lamar. Now, please, come on. Is that the most important thing in our Bilalian or African-American or Black, however you want to identify yourself, be a person of color, whatever, the most important thing happening in the world today, the beef between Drake and Kendrick Lamar? And those kind of things are not accidental, you know. The main media outlets, what do they have? I mean, they're just shoving Trump's trial down our throat 24/7. That's all they're talking about. Meantime, people are starving in Sudan. People are starving in Palestine. Chaos in Haiti. All of these important things that maybe every now and then they'll give you a little breaking news kind of interruption, and maybe you'll get 1 or 2 minutes of it. But what is actually happening in the rest of the world? You know, there have been plenty of world governments where the current or the former leader of that government has gone on trial for corruption. So, yes, it's the first time for us here, but I mean, you know, give me a break. There's more going on in the world, but again, no accident. Wanting to divert our attention from these real pressing issues that the youth of our country are dramatically bringing our attention to, and I celebrate them in their brave efforts in doing that. And I don't want to dominate the conversation, but those are just some kind of random thoughts that I've had, Cheryl, as far as what's been going on. And I was encouraged also recently to hear, I think in the last 2 days, that Egypt is going to join South Africa with the International Court of Justice suit against Israel. So that's encouraging, and hopefully more countries will sign on. And it's the thing that's so encouraging about that is because for decades, Israel and Egypt have had a peace agreement. So for Egypt to take this this very dramatic and important step, I think is signaling, and I hope that other Arab countries will wake up and be more supportive of justice for the Palestinian cause. And so that's just a few of the things that have been on my mind, and we'll get into some more things as we continue our conversation. Has there been any specific issue in world events that have been on your mind too, Sister Cheryl?
Well, I believe in only speak of it and prove the silence, and you kind of label all of them. I think that it's, I'm going to bring it to one word, and I think it's because it's distraction, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's distraction.
Yes.
If people keep following the bouncing ball or the shining light,
yeah,
they will forget about the things that really matter, especially as we head into this election season. You know, it's really easy to get caught up in, you know, the trial and the student protest, which they say is less than 5% of students, period. But if you watch the news, you would think different. They did a poll, and the polling of 16 issues said that this Middle Eastern conflict, this conflict and Israel conflict, ranked 14th, the young people. What they really are more concerned about is housing, jobs, and their student debt. Those are the top three.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that part of the issue is that this is really important to a lot of students. When I talk to my students, my children, and their friends, they do believe it's really important, and they speak out, you know, in against the killing and the genocide. But there's so much that they have to contend with, and that I believe that it's almost counterintuitive not to flood the airlines and to be more strategic in how news is reported, because we've seen this in many of the conflicts around the world. People, and with the whole Black Lives Matter movement, it's people become desensitized when they see it, or they become frustrated and disenchanted, and they shut down. It's a human reaction. They start to shut down and say, I don't even want to look at the news. I've heard many adults say this, not just young adults, but many, even my own generation, saying, I don't even watch the news anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which is disheartening, but it also is just, and it's almost a, when I speak to people and they tell me, I ask them why not, it's a mechanism, a self-care mechanism, to not want to have it. If I don't see it, news, it's like the child hiding behind the little skinny pole when they're playing hide and seek. They can't see me, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I don't watch the news, if I don't listen to these programs, then maybe it's not as bad as I'm making it out to be in my head. And, you know, it's the job of anybody, somebody, nobody, everybody but me to care and to do something about it. And these, like I said, I think there's a strategic way that we have to handle these kind of matters that cut at the core of people's humanity and their faith and belief and just their values. And so it's that is where I see the work. I see that is where we need to do the most building, is making sure that they're not othering the people. And I will say the people in the Palestine region. I don't want to say just Palestinians, because it's more than Palestinians that are getting harmed by what is going on, as well as people in the Sudan, in the Congo, in, you know, Ethiopia and Eritrea, in Yemen, in South America, and in all of these war-torn places of Ukraine and Russia, all of these war-torn places, if you can't get people to see the people who are being harmed in a humane sense, it's easy to make statements like Lindsey Graham made about we must stand behind Israel no matter what. We must not. He's upset because Biden maybe is not sending any more of the mass weapons, right? They didn't say no weapons. They just said they're not sending any more of the bombs that are capable of destroying. Yes, it will destroy an entire, the small areas, instead of, as they previously said, targeted, and a targeted offensive. If you're looking for a mosque, you're not finding, and their excuse is they're hiding in the elementary schools, they're hiding in the libraries and the massages and the hospitals. So let's just blow the whole thing up. And you know what? Casualties are part of war. It is what it is. Hamas shouldn't have started it. That is the conversation that's going on, rather than you have some of the most sophisticated weaponry because you're getting it from the United States. 60% of the weaponry comes from the United States. And it allows them to... Say it again?
Yeah, I think 68% comes from the U.S. Yeah.
Yes.
To Israel.
The ability to make it more targeted, if you know you have substantial evidence of where you're targeting. But I can't be upset with somebody if I found my rapist or my daughter's offender, and I knew he lived in a certain neighborhood of Oakland. I can't just drop a bomb in Oakland, just kill everybody hoping that I got that person. They may not even be there anymore. Likely they left, right? So I think the other thing is that now you have created, the last thing I was going to say on this is now you've created not only the almost a hard shell to see in the news, you've created Hamas sympathizers. Because I'm not going to, I think it's wrong for what Hamas did. I think it's wrong what Israel is doing. And I think it's wrong what even, now they're in survival mode. But now Hamas has managed to recruit a lot more fighters, including here in the United States and some of the universities. So there's no strategy here that I see. And even on the university campuses, the reason I said it was 5% students is they arrested like 2,300, and of that, there was less than 200 that were actual students. Now it might include some alumni, but most of them are people from the community or people who, especially when you see these ones who are fighting and wreaking havoc, they went there for that reason. They didn't go for it. They're not there to protest what's happening. They're there to wreak havoc. And again, distract. I think that it's a distraction. I won't be surprised if we find out later they were paid, just like the BLM during the BLM days, where when there was a march or protest that was peaceful, and then someone would come along and start, you know, wreaking havoc, and then found out that they were paid to do that. Some of them were even law enforcement doing it, right? So I think that we've got to learn from this and just figure out how to, I don't know, how to touch people's basic humanity. That's all.
Okay. I want to continue on that, some of what you touched on. I'm going to use the approach that the Israelis use when they contradict these figures, the death toll in Gaza. And they say, oh, well, you know, those figures come from the Health Administration, and they're part of the Hamas ruling government. So therefore, we count the figures. That 200 out of 2,500, I don't believe that at all. And I think we have to really look at those figures. I don't doubt that there have been people in the various encampments who may not be students. They may be community people, and they might be activists who are reliving their activism from the 1960s and 70s and, you know, protested every war that has happened since the 60s. But I think the emphasis on those things is a part of the strategy that part of the strategy on the lobbyists, the Israeli and the Zionist lobbyists, to distract, I'll use your word distract, away from what is being asked, what is being demanded by the students. If it's just one student in an encampment of 100, who is demanding something? What is that student demanding? I think there are a couple of things that that feed into that narrative. Oh, these outside people and the students, you know, at these elite institutions. I think number one, the attack on the administrators and the students. Coming from largely conservative voices is to distract away from what is actually happening on the ground in Gaza right now. But not only Gaza, but also the West Bank, because the West Bank is greatly underreported, and there has been an escalation in the West Bank of killing, arresting, Palestinians without just cause, and also stealing more land, burning houses, taking houses away. And so to distract from that and to distract from the demand of the students to divest from what Eisenhower, Republican President Eisenhower, military general Eisenhower, warned us of, that military industrial complex, the money that's being made off of the war. And before October 7th, a lot was being covered as far as with the war in Ukraine, the technology that Ukraine was being used as a lab, and a lot of it pointed back to Israel as a lab for the use of AI technology in conducting war. So these things are very important. When the students say, you know, divest from the corporations that are benefiting from the, then they use the word genocide that is happening in Gaza, it's critical that we look at, and I salute the administration at Brown University, because they negotiated with the students and they have agreed to look at their portfolio and divest from those companies that are profiteering off of the loss of the human life that we see. I think that it's important for us to see that and to also realize that the Israeli lobbyists, AIPAC and its affiliates, have for years developed a strong PR program coming out of the government representatives and officials in Israel with AIPAC and ADL. With we talked about this last week when Brother Fleming was giving a report about the advocacy, and we hope that he will, in a few minutes after we take a PSA, give us some more of his report back on that. But they come with the same talking points, and the journalists in the corporate media of America, they use the same talking points that Netanyahu uses, that his cabinet officials uses when they're giving formal presentations to the worldwide media, when they are giving a presentation to settler organizations and whatnot in Israel. They have a whole different set of talking points. Talking points, you will hear them run through all the way to the halls of Congress, same talking points, October 7th, worse than 9/11, Israel's 9/11, worse suffering that Israel has had since World War II. Yes, and then when you look at the statistics on the number of Israelis who have been killed since 1948, to the current time versus the number of Palestinians that have been killed, there is no comparison. We talk about, and the 1,200 figure for October 7th, that's in question. That has been walked back a couple of times by the IDF. Some of it was friendly fire. We don't hear about how much was actually when the Israeli forces finally got to the place where this outdoor concert was being held, the friendly fire there, as well as in some of the kibbutzes, where it was actually Israeli forces that started some of these fires that killed some of the people. But, you know, all of that is going to come out once we can settle the ground with a ceasefire and once hostages can be returned. And we should not go with what Israel wants, I don't believe, for what happens afterwards. There's been reporting that Israel wants to maintain civic control of Gaza for 6 months to a year, and the Arab states pick up the cost of reconstituting and paying for the damage that Israel has done to the infrastructure, the housing, the educational. Every university in Palestine has been destroyed. The schools have been destroyed. The hospitals, they have maybe, I think they have two hospitals that are functioning in Rafah right now. And they're on the verge of collapse because oil hasn't gotten in to power the generators for the hospital. So there's a lot to be looked at, and there's a lot that comes out of us, that comes at us. But I think that the students have been very thoughtful, and they have been very strategic in what they have done. And we should be grateful because they are the conscience for what is going on. Now, they've been accused of being harassing Jewish students and anti-Semitic in their talk and in their rhetoric. But I want to ask Mike Johnson and Elise Stefanik and the other members of Congress, where were you and what did you say after Charlottesville when you had your Tiki Karen, KKK, and American Nazi groups marching through in Charlottesville talking about the Jews will not replace us? Why didn't anti-Semitism legislation come up then? Why is it coming up now? And what did the leader of your party say? Oh, there were good people on both sides of that demonstration. So we can't have such a short memory that we just go with what the current soundbite in the corporate media. But I've gone on long enough. Brother Fleming, I think, has joined us, and he's also going to give us some more information on the U.S. Coalition of Muslim Organizations, their advocacy day on Capitol Hill, which would be good information for us to have. And it'll tie into the rest of what we're saying. But I want to just do this one thing before we go on break to cap what we started out with, saluting Sister Fitra and the Study Al-Islam team and the information they shared regarding Mother's Day, which is it's a day that a lot of money flows on Mother's Day. But the sentiment is a good sentiment. And I want to read from Surah Al-Isra, chapter 17, verses 23 and 24. And it may seem like a divergence, but we're going to tie all of this together. And this comes from a posting on the Daily Sunnah online. And it says, a person came to the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that is, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, and asked, who among people is most deserving of my fine treatment? The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, your mother. He again asked, who next? Your mother, replied again, peace be on him. He asked, who next? The Prophet, peace be upon him, said again, your mother. He again asked, then who? Thereupon he, peace be upon him, the Prophet said, then your father. So we have these three times the Prophet is saying, your mother, your mother, your mother, and then your father. Sister Anissa Dewan did a beautiful, beautiful tafsir on those ayats from the Quran. And then it goes on to say in this posting from the Daily Sunnah, Musa alayhi salam, that is the Prophet Musa, once asked Allah who would be his neighbor in paradise. Allah informed him it would be a butcher from a far land. Confused and wanting to understand this man's virtues, Musa alayhi salam asked Allah to meet him. Allah guided him to the distant land where he found the butcher at work. Musa alayhi salam observed the butcher discreetly, curious about what unique deeds elevated this seemingly ordinary man to such a high spiritual state. However, after hours of observation, Musa, peace be on him, say, saw nothing noteworthy. Being a traveler, he asked the butcher if he could host him for the night. The butcher gladly agreed to welcome him, and they went to his modest house near the river. Musa, peace be upon him, was welcomed, but asked to wait as the butcher attended a private matter. He watched as the butcher brought a large basket from inside his home. Inside was an old, frail woman, well wrapped in sheets and fur. The butcher lifted her out and tenderly bathed her in the river, washed and cleaned her clothes, combed her hair, and started a fire to keep her warm while preparing a meal from the meat he had brought back. The entire time, the butcher was attentively listening, sharing stories, and laughing with the woman. Luther, peace be on him, was deeply moved by such compassion and care. When the man finished cooking, he sat close to her, eating from a single plate. He would chew the food and then feed her the morsel. The woman murmured something with each bite of the meal, though Musa, peace be on him, was too far away to hear. After the meal, the butcher prayed with her and gently settled the woman back into her basket for the night. Only then did he join Musa for dinner, revealing that the woman was his mother who had fallen ill. He explained how he alone takes care of her, managing her every need to the extent of even chewing food for her since she has lost her teeth. He then told Musa, peace be on him, that he had devoted himself to this daily and nightly routine for the past 10 years. He even refused marriage to ensure he had no distraction from his commitment to her. Musa, curious, asked about the prayers his mother whispered. The butcher explained that with each mouthful, she repeated the same prayer. Allahumma ja'alnuhu ma'an nabiyyin. O Allah, put him in the rank and in the height of the prophets of God. Every moment of hers would be spent repeating this prayer to Allah. Overwhelmed by the man's selfless service and their connection, Musa, peace be upon him, continuously wept. The power of a mother's dua elevated a simple butcher to prophetic status in the eyes of Allah. Sincerity and service hold a profound place, especially when directed towards one's mother or any maternal figure. Such acts are not merely duties, but deep spiritual practices that cleanse the heart and draw us closer to Allah. By serving our mothers with genuine love and respect, we engage in a sacred dialogue with our Creator, fostering a spiritual wellness that echoes through our lives and beyond. So I thought that that was a very beautiful reminder to us the thoughts and the remembrance of Mother's Day, and especially after the program that Study Al-Islam had. And I think that it's important for us to remember the mothers in Palestine, in Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Congo, all over the world, who are the victims of corruption and oppressive governments and even natural disasters, the suffering and the sacrifices that they make. And we pray Allah will bless all of them. And so I'm going to ask Sister Cheryl if we'll have Brother Fleming to greet us, and then we'll have a PSA, and then we'll come back to the comments that he has for us regarding the update on the Muslim. So, Brother Fleming, Alameen.
As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam.
I've been enjoying the conversation, and quite natural I have a 30-second response, so we'll talk about that after our PSAs. Glad to be a part of the team.
Alhamdulillah. Okay, so we'll go to our PSA, and then we'll come back in and ask Brother Fleming to give us an update on the U.S. Muslim U.S. Coalition of Muslim Organizations advocacy. Sister Cheryl, it's on you.
Ma'am, do not touch that dial. We'll be right back with Matt 5.
God's peace be upon you. God's love be upon you. God's compassion be upon you. The one soul of humanity. May we let it be in thought and in action. On behalf of CWSC Intelligentsia, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected, American Muslim 360, the Speakers Bureau, the Model Community National Resource Directory, the Volunteer Human Resource Network, Scholarship, the Learning Lab, Ambassadors, National Leadership Advisory Council, Internship, Leadership Development Council, the Think Tank, Strategic Family Institute, the bookstore. May we share completely humanity in spirit and in form, from thought to action. God's peace, God's love, God's compassion. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. This is the Preacher Hadi, host of Al Islam and Focus Learning Lab here on AM 360, inviting you to join me Saturday evening at our new time, 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, as we continue to share inspiring and thought-provoking Islamic education. Inshallah, I will see you in the lab at our new time, 5 to 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Saturday evening. Assalamu alaikum, and thank you kindly.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Nirmat Shaheed, restorative justice practitioner for the Oakland Unified School District and host on AM 360's The Pearls of Women Quranic Mondays. We're asking you to help us make a difference in the life of a student. We need you to spread the word that CWSC is offering 5 college scholarships in the form of direct financial aid to students who qualify and are graduating from high school this year or current college students. Learn more and apply online today at cwsc.us. But hurry, the deadline for applications is June the 20th. Thank you for helping secure our next generation's intelligentsia. Assalamu alaikum.
Join us for Muslim American Power 5 on Mondays, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Muslim American Power 5, referred to as MAP 5, featuring Sister Amatullah Sabri, Sister Cheryl Sadi, and Brother Fleming Alamein. That's Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time for MAP, Muslim American Power 5.
Yes, ma'am, we are back live. Welcome, audience, to Muslim American Power 5, MAP 5, featuring Sister Matala Lajer Debris, Brother Fleming Yalameen, and I am Cheryl Sutton. And we are here continuing our discussion of faith into action. Adam, back to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Brother Fleming, was there additional information you wanted to give us on the Advocacy Day on Capitol Hill? Brother Fleming, can you hear me?
Can you hear me okay now?
Now we can hear you.
Can you hear?
Yes.
Okay, alhamdulillah. Yeah, we had, most recently, we had the 4 major organizations of the United States Council of Muslim Organizations to agree on a memorandum of understanding. And that was, of course, we have on that founding organizational structure, the Mosque Cares, you have CARE, who joined this year was Islamic Relief, you have ISNA, and a few other ones. And we came about with this because there were some concerns by some of our youth participants this year at the 9th Annual National Muslim Advocacy Day on Capitol Hill. And so we sort of agreed to sign this memorandum of understanding to make sure we're all on the same page when it comes to legislative matters, because the concept is to have the same message to each congressperson, each senator, and to ask for the same resolutions and to same support. So we have one basic agenda going forward. And unfortunately, we have some of our younger people who were not as attuned to the need for protocol when it comes to that kind of engagement with elected officials. And so we had to sort of make the adjustment and the overall organizational planning for next year, inshallah. But I think there was a very effective result from our request for humanitarian aid and to stop this senseless bombing. And so I'm going to tell you why the type of bombing that there was a pause on, those bombs drill into the earth so many feet, they may be a quarter of a mile before they explode. So they really destroy everything in their capacity in that area with huge collateral. And so you have total destruction behind those kind of bombs being dropped like that. So it has a massive collateral damage. And so that is the first step, alhamdulillah, to bring some sense to what's going on over there. But I want to just comment briefly on what's been discussed so far. Most of us know that media in general is just pictures and stories. It's pictures and storytelling. And we've been getting some pictures that were not reflective of the whole situation. And I think Sister Cheryl sort of hit it on the head when she said that there's also massive undertakings of total destruction in countries like the Sudan. In the Congo, there have been over 6 million people displaced. I mean, you can go around the world with different locations around the world, and why aren't we seeing those pictures in the media? We have to have a universal approach to this matter when it comes to humanity. By all means, the tragedy, the genocide in Gaza should be addressed by every civilized government and person to address that issue. But we got to remember that there are other concerns around the world, too, that we just cannot simply ignore and just focus on one in this particular case. And yeah, I brought that to the attention of some of the guys who are organizing this for next year. We've got to, you know, just make this an objective, and we're going to fine-tune it, too, to just one specific focus when it comes to the issue in Gaza and Israelis. We said it, and I recommend it said it again, what happened in South Africa with apartheid. Why was that campaign so successful? It didn't happen overnight, but in the end, you had a lot of people who agreed that we need to divest in support of the government there. And so all the other concerns around that and what happened to Mandela, et cetera, they were important. But the thing that really moved the government to really change eventually and bring Nelson Mandela into the presidency eventually was the world at large saw the need to divest in supporting financially the government of South Africa. And that divestiture program worked eventually. And so the resolve in the situation with the United States Council of Muslim Organizations was to raise a sharp our focus on that issue of divestiture from Israeli government as long as this war is continuing. Now, I mentioned last week that there were three other things that were also was presented during the legislative session, and we'll comment on those, you know, going forward in far more detail. But before I forget, I want to bring some good news. Our discussion also. We had a guest of honor this weekend here in Winston-Salem. It was, I think it's the 30th year doing Family Unity Day scholarship banquets, and we have an interfaith component to that and a culture component. And this year we had the same Imam Fahim Shuaib from your area as our guest speaker and presenter, and we had the mayor of Winston-Salem to declare yesterday as Imam Fahim Shuaib Day in the city of Winston-Salem. We gave him a proclamation. And it was wonderful to attend there with a massive crowd. And, of course, as always, he delivers a very thought-provoking presentation for the students. We had 7 students this year to receive scholarships. And, again, as I said, they've been doing this here at least 30 years. And that's somewhat of an uplifting incident. So I said, Alhamdulillah. Brother Imam Shiraf has been there several times, but I think this was one of the best presentations he's made. And the students are really writing notes as he was speaking, because he gave them some things that they could feed off of and grow from in the future, not just the students, but just as human beings, period. And so I just want to thank him publicly again. And we had the chief of police also to come to support the effort and other people that we invited, and they responded positively. So that is a part of the media also, presenting those pictures of things that are being done to promote humanity, you know, in our community. And let's just keep that in mind, that we got to put our own pictures out there sometimes, our own independent pictures and our perspective of what's happening in the world and our local communities, you know, in general, and let the people know, keep them informed, keep them engaged, and keep our faith indeed in action. I've said enough to start off with. We want to continue some other discussions later through our previous conversation. I know I was really inspired by the comments earlier. You know, I used to be involved in doing some PR work for marketing companies, and we would always say, you got to go through the first four P's of marketing first. Define your product specifically. What are you trying to put in the market? Is it a good? Is it a service? Exactly what is it? Take the time to define your product. That was the first P. The second P, what is your place in the market? Are you on the top shelf, the mother shelf, the bottom shelf? In other words, you got to study your competition to see who you're competing against. But then you got to come up with a method of promoting it. What is your promotional scheme or process or specific plan to promote your product in the marketplace? And then those three things will give you your final P, which is your price. And you make your price based on those first three, so you have a competitive price and hopefully last more than 5 years in the marketplace, even though most startups barely last for 5 years. But that was just something I was reminded of as I was listening to the conversation earlier. We have to be very mindful of, you know, current things that impact our community, principles that we should sort of abide by, and our humanitarian outlook on the world should represent a balanced perspective. No extremes on either side, but a balanced perspective with some resolutions that people can hopefully come to the table and sit down and agree upon. I'll pause there because I know that our sister has a specific agenda for this afternoon's discussion, and I'll wait for further instructions from my sister here. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for that that update. And so I just want to make sure I understand. With this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding with the organization, Brother Fleming, can you just give us three or four things that you said were the specific areas that it covered? So, in other words, this MOU was an agreement between the organizations of the USCMO as far as we can agree on these three or four things, and this is what we're going to go forward with when we're dealing with the legislators or their representatives that we'll be united on. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, ma'am, that's exactly right. And what they went back to was who were the founders of this idea of a United States Council of Muslim Organizations. The concept was to have an umbrella organization that all Muslims would have a voice in, unifying Muslim voices advocating for justice, equality, human rights. And so that was the premise. And some of those founding organizations, of course, included, as I said before, CARE was one of them, ISM was one of them, the Mosque CARES was one of them. Islamic Relief was not initially, but they came on board eventually. You have other ones like Impact, et cetera, plus seven that were involved in forming this organization. And a lot of the language came from Imam Talib Sharif out of Washington, D.C. When you go back and look at some of the original language when it first was formed, he was very much engaged, and he was representing, of course, Mosque CARES in developing the language for the United States Council of Muslim Organizations. And so that was a need because this year, for the first time since I have been involved, and I've been involved for about, I said, 9 years, I think I missed one, maximum two, because usually I represent ACGG and I represent a co-captain of the North Carolina delegation. So I sort of play two roles in that effort. And we've been very successful because we were so accustomed to working with each other. We had never had this many young people to participate and first-timers. And to give you an example, when I was on the platform, you know, I always try to look for young people. I said, everybody, 35 and under, please stand. I want to recognize you. And so the brother who was taking those secretary kind of responsibility, he said, we have about 60% of young people on the 35. That's the first time that has ever happened. And then they sat down and they said, all those that are here for the very first time as delegates, please stand. And on that occasion, we had 70% of the people there. Now, this is out of 720 delegates from around the country. So it was sort of a new mixture of people. And you had people who've been there somewhere, you could call them seasoned, who've been there for a while, but we should have probably had a more concentrated orientation to make sure the first time, and that was a limited one on the day of the first day, the first part of the morning, professor would, you know, explain what we would be doing, you know, who was sort of in charge of each state, who you go to for information, you know, et cetera, general information like that. But what was missing was, what is the protocol? When you go into the office of an elected official like a congressman or a senator, and that was a part of the MMA, you owe the memorandum of understanding going forward, they would have a specified protocol identified on paper. So when you address these representatives, you do it in a manner that you can maintain relationships and not have a negative impact on our future relationships with these people, because elected officials change, but our relationships should continue forward. And as I said earlier, we had a few little minor incidents of young people who were just so passionate that they wanted to, let me just say, stand up and shout instead of talking rational to some of the people that they were asked to come into the offices with. And that sort of turned off some of the representatives' staff, administrative staff. And, of course, we tried to smooth over that when we finally got notification that indeed that had occurred. And so the team captains, once we found out about it, we kind of went in and tried to say, okay, this is what they really meant. They're just passing. They're somewhat young. It's not another process. And this is what we really were trying to achieve. And we thank you for your time you gave us, because God willing, we'll be back next year again. And we wrote them letters. And it wasn't that many, but it was enough to sort of bring to our attention the need going forward to make sure we have people who can follow, you know, protocol. And that's important. And, you know, I've been doing this for a number of years, so I know that some of them, they didn't mean no harm. They thought that was the way to behave, but indeed, there is a protocol when you're dealing with elected officials that you should at least be aware of. So that was one of the matters that we were concerned about. The other one was that we didn't want to go outside of the things that we agreed upon that we've been working on for about a year to make up the legislative agenda. And very briefly, I just go over a couple of them just to give you an idea. We usually have just four items. This year we had, number one, U.S. House of Representatives and Senators combating anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia on college campuses. And that one came about because we heard that some administrators at some of these campuses, for those students who were involved, were being sent to what they call honor courses, et cetera. And their graduation could be challenged, or their status on the campus could be challenged. And so we wrote some specific things in that regard that we wanted them to address, so no harm will come to them who were peacefully protesting. That was the key. The second one was the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate demanding an immediate end to U.S. military aid to Israel. And we know that was a long shot. We want to make it a point of discussion regardless. And we gave rationales why that's identified already what we had on, in place federal law to support why we should do that. And we discussed that, of course, last week. Number three was U.S. House of Representatives and Senate urging for humanitarian aid, reconstruction, and recovery assistance to Gaza and, of course, Palestine. And as Sister Cheryl said, there are a lot of people who live in that area that we should be aware of, too. They're not just Palestinians, but that's the majority of the population, of course. And the last one was just what we call umbrella issue. And on that one, we had the 2024-118th Congress, other top legislative priorities. Number one, of course, the House and Senate urges the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to expand large business for Americans. Two, U.S. Senate support the Dale Maggie's judicial nomination for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Number three, House and Senate co-sponsor support the Muhammad Ali Congressional Gold Medal Act. which is, of course, you know, House of H.R. 709 and Senate 3842. It's been discussed for some time. We want them to take more action to make it a reality. Number six, House and Senate co-sponsor and support Muslim American Heritage Month resolution. Some states have already done that. Number five, House and Senate co-sponsor and support Combating International Islamophobia Act. We've done that before, of course. We repeated again. And number six, close backdoor search and data brokerage loopholes in FICE inspections 702 reauthorization. And that sort of gives you a general summary of the issues that we had brought before the Senate and, of course, the representatives. I think I mentioned last week we had 100 meetings. I got updated on that. We actually had 145 meetings with different representatives and senators across the country. Now, that was not enough. Of the reality that we have 435 congressional people and 100 senators gives us 535 potential meetings that we could have had. All 145 responded positively. But even with that, we went into every congressional office and left information, even if we did not get an invitation, just to let them know who were in the area and wanted them to have this for the research and for their consideration. And we hope we get a response to them, you know, in the very near future. So all of them got the information, regardless of whether we got the personal time in the office or not. Okay, so that's it, the context of it. And, of course, in your own sort of specified going forward. I'm sorry, go ahead. Is there a question?
No, go ahead. Finish. I have a question, but I'll wait until you finish your point.
Okay. Yeah, so those are some of the elements of what you wanted to have done at this, you know, 9th Annual National Muslim Advocacy Day on Capitol Hill. And we don't want people to come in with their own items and not to vote what we had agreed upon, you know, as a unit. And that was another part of the end goal. Let's stick to the agenda, stick to the protocol, and by all means, keep in mind that we're building relationships with people long term. Long term. I'm sorry, you had a question. Yes, ma'am.
I forgot where it was, but I know it was on some forum. It might have been on a previous broadcast. I had asked, or I had shared that a professor from Wisconsin's law school hadn't been on Capitol Hill in a while, and when she went recently, she noticed that there was, outside of many, many of them, an American flag and the Israeli flag. And there had been a broadcast on, it may have been on Nova Media, a woman who, I think she was British, who, maybe she was a journalist, some research she had done, she had found out that there were so many elected American citizens, representatives, who had dual citizenship with Israel. So I had asked the question, those that have this Israeli flag outside of their door, are they also those who have dual citizenship with Israel? And I'm asking you, or no, it was Brother McCall, when he was on, Robert McCall, I had suggested that we ask the question, or find out if the people that have these two flags in front of their door, if the representative is a dual citizen with Israel. Two questions for you. Did you notice those flags? And then also, did the question of dual citizenship come up in any of your meetings with the representatives or research on the representatives?
Yeah, when we went to the offices, what came to our attention the most was them having statements of support outside of our offices, and in some cases, the actual Israeli flag. There was not a research topic on who had those citizenships that I'm aware of. Now, I raised the issue in all the meetings that I personally attended that as a reminder. I said, you know, I remember a lot of our representatives flying the yellow and blue flag for the Ukrainian government when they were invaded by the Soviet Union or Russia, and there was a sense of unity to support their country because they were being invaded. If you're going to fly one flag, why don't you fly both flags at least? Now, some did not have a flag at all, but a lot of them did have some kind of stick outside their doors on their position, you know, with the Israeli government, or in some cases they actually had the flag that was flying. And so to answer your question specifically, no research that I'm aware of was done. Perhaps Robert has had a chance to assign that to someone, you know, since we, of course, met in D.C. I know they're always doing research, you know, in that regard. And I can find out if indeed they were able to find that information. But I think the point that he was trying to make also, even in our discussion with him, was that even with that being on their doors, we would still want them to support our position, give us an up or down vote, and then we'll know how to work with you going forward in terms of support or not supporting your campaign, period, or putting out information in your positions and reasons why. But that is a very good question to raise. I know that even when I was in Ghana, I was given an adoption by one of the villages that we attended. They had a whole ceremony, a name ceremony, and so they gave me a new name. So I was always now an official citizen of the Ghanaian government, and I could always come back home. Now, part of it, I think, was just ceremonial, but they did go through that process. And I asked them, I said, well, you know, I know a little bit about dual citizenship, and let me do my research first before I accept the official dual citizenship, because I know there are some positives and some negatives in that effort there. So I held back on going through the legal process. But it's a very good question, and I think it's one that we should perhaps pursue. What I encourage them also to do is just follow the contributions. It's public information. And most of them have to, you know, release their support. It's required by federal law. You can see where the contributions come from. And I did discover that we had one young sister from North Carolina who I used to work with. We were both county commissioners for a while, and we supported her to become a congressman from her district. And, you know, she released her statements because she was asked to release her financial statements like everyone else does. And she got 75% of her support from Israeli-supported or Jewish-supported entities in the country. And she refused to have a meeting with us. But she went by her office anyway and left some information. But so I know that with even a closer perspective on them, if we follow the money and find out where the funding is coming from, because that will speak volumes on the positions on a lot of issues that we're concerned about, you know, inshallah.
Okay. Talking about legislation, we do know that the representatives in a 320 to 91 vote, many Democrats supported this, on May 1st passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. And the website PolitiFact from the Poynter Institute published an article by Lewis Jacobson on May 10th that kind of goes over what this particular legislation entails. And he says that the bill came to a vote amid pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses against the Israel-Hamas war that some Jewish students said they found threatening. It produced an unusual lineup of supporters and detractors. Although the legislation passed easily and with bipartisan support, the votes against it were also bipartisan. 21 Republicans and 70 Democrats voted no. Some Republicans who voted no cited possible threats to Christian beliefs. Some Democrats said the measure would chill political speech critical of Israel's government rather than Jews as a group. And Representative Nadler was one who voted against it. He's Jewish. He supports Israel. But he also felt that the legislation, this isn't from the article, I'm just giving people background, that the legislation would definitely chill free speech, which is a constitutional right, First Amendment constitutional right. And so Jacobson in his reporting says, what does the bill say? The bill requires the Federal Education Department to use the definition of anti-Semitism outlined by the Stockholm-based International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance when addressing allegations of discrimination in higher education. So in other words, the Education Department, I think under Title VI, has to investigate when there are incidents that are reported as discrimination, and if the institution, education institution, hasn't handled the situation properly and they file a complaint with the Education Department, they have to investigate. So now this bill requires the Education Department to use the definition that this Stockholm-based International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance when they investigate. So they have to use that definition when they investigate allegations of discrimination in higher education. If discrimination is determined to have occurred, schools would be at risk of losing federal funding. Currently, there is no standard definition for anti-Semitism in such discrimination cases. Now, the thing that is interesting about this is the legislation says that they have to use this IHRA definition. The IHRA, they provide education for people, this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. It's not a governmental agency. It has partners. But it's important to note that that in their setting up this definition on May 26, 2016, it says the plenary in Bucharest, where they had the plenary discussion, decided to adopt the following non-legally binding working definition of anti-Semitism. So in other words, their intent was not to make this definition a legal definition, and it's non-legally binding. This is the organization that came up with the definition. And they said anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. So this is their definition of anti-Semitism. Now, it's interesting when they, in their definition, they say manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property. Who are those non-Jewish individuals or property? Palestinians.
Well,
Semitic people who speak Semitic languages. Jewish people are not
be.
The only Semitic people. So,
Hold on a minute.
It says anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. That's a contradiction, because later on they also include non-Jewish individuals. So you're saying that a Semitic person who may criticize the Israeli government, a non-Jewish Semitic person who criticizes an Israeli government, that they're an anti-Semite? Illogical, and it's a contradiction. Go ahead, Cheryl.
It is in that sense. It may be illogical, but I also think that it is, from what I've seen in practice, when people use the word anti-Semitic anything of that like. And it's not just anti-Semitism, it's also Islamophobia and other things. When they're talking about people who are not Jewish, right, it can mean what you said, but it also can mean people who use tropes that are disparaging to Jewish people, and they become offended because it's viewed from the lens of Jewish people. So if someone uses, I don't want to say any, but if someone uses, disparaging comments that they attribute to Jewish people, even though they're not talking about Jewish people. Like, there's some terms when people say, they use it in, like, when someone is trying to get over on someone or someone is beating someone at something and they feel like they've been gypped, right? There's a saying for that. That is very disparaging to Jewish people. That is where that part comes from my understanding. Or making, comments about, Jews run the entertainment or jewelry business, but making it in a way that is disparaging. So it's not just about that area. I'm saying this because I want people to understand this is not just about the Israeli war on Palestine, period. So this is broader than that, which makes it more dangerous. So that's why I wanted to just interject to say, yes, we are dealing with the current issue, but that is not what they were doing. They are trying to pass a law that you cannot make any disparaging comments, not just against the Israeli government, but that Jewish people view as anti-Semitic, even if it's not about this. That is what's happening. What I heard and my perspective on it, I just wanted to bring that up.
That's very important, Sister Charlotte, because they also, I don't know if it's gone through the committee yet, but just to support what you're saying, Sister Cheryl, they've drafted up similar legislation to apply to nonprofit entities, period, who would be using, threatened to lose their nonprofit status if indeed they're found guilty of anti-Semitism. So it's very, very dangerous what they're trying to do, and we have to really be aware of the consequences. Because if that becomes law, of course someone has to enforce it. That's a whole other issue. Who's going to be the one responsible for enforcing it, and what's going to be the appellate process, and how do you specifically define if someone is indeed using anti-Semitic language? What does that specifically mean in a court of law? How will it hold up in a court of law? And so if you get this legislation, I'm trying to find the exact number on this piece of legislation, but it applies to every nonprofit entity as well. And if they find them, quote, guilty of, this heated anti-Semitism genre that they're passing out now, they can challenge their, quote, nonprofit status and challenge them to potentially lose their nonprofit status. Now, just think about what that could mean to anyone in this country who has a nonprofit entity, mosque, masjids, nonprofit humanitarian efforts and organizations, anyone who's trying to build, a more universal approach to getting things done beyond just labeling, could be challenged if they use any kind of component that could be identified as anti-Semitism. So it's very, very dangerous, brothers and sisters. So we really have to stay on top of what do they really mean, these legislators, when they say specifically anti-Semitism? Now, if they had enough research then, they would know that Semites are Arabs and Jews. I mean, it's not as clear historically as people try to pretend it is today. And so we have to be very specific. Give me a specific definition of what anti-Semitism means when it comes to legal application in a court of law, to accuse someone of doing that. Now, you have to even prove a hate crime today in court. There's a process involving proving this was done to you based on what we have on the books called a hate crime. And if it's proven that indeed it was a hate crime, there's a consequence. What happens if you're charged with anti-Semitism? What's the result in a court case like that? and what are the elements or the facts involved, and they prove that. So it's very critical we stay on top of this, and whoever represents you in the Legislative Assembly, I know we have just David Shaheed in Indiana, who's already on top of this. He just got back from Umrah, where he took his four daughters over there, in fact. But he and a group of judges and former judges are working on something like this in the state of Indiana to oppose it. So there are some elements working, I would say, in the behalf of them, you know, putting some brakes on that kind of application of anti-Semitism across the board, the way they're trying to use it, because it can be very, very harmful. And why is there such an emphasis today on this? Because there's a lot of passion and emotionalism out there about what they're saying, the, you know, October 7th, most horrific thing that happened to them since the Holocaust. And they're using that kind of charge words to make people think that this is the worst thing that's ever happened to people in the history of mankind. And so people are responding that way, unfortunately. So we have to be mindful, be very critical. And language is so important. Words are so important. And so we have to challenge them when they use that kind of language.
Exactly. The rhetoric. The rhetoric is meant to inflame passions rather than sensibilities. And we have to always, always, always practice the discipline as not just as Muslims, but people of faith and conscientiousness to look at the sensibility of what you're feeling and thinking before you act. Just one thing I wanted to tell you, brother, that last week I read a case came down in California. They sent to me, I saw it on the legal wire, that a judge in the Ninth Circuit reaffirmed that you do not have to prove harm. And this was dealing with employment law, but I can see it going further. As case law moving forward, the judge approved that in cases of in claims of discrimination and bias that are against a protected class, the person who is alleging the discrimination does not have to prove harm. So this takes on a whole other light when you're thinking about these new laws with anti-Semitism. They don't have to prove that the words or the actions cause harm, just that they believe that they've been discriminated against in some form or fashion. Again, the words make a difference. The rhetoric is meant for a reason. And I just mean that we can do so much protesting, but the best vote to get to the ballot and put people in office who are going to not vote against our interest. Madam?
In a statement, so this passed out of the House, Brother Funny, and went to the Senate. And had, as far as I know, Schumer hasn't brought it up. Tim Scott, if you Google him on YouTube, they have they do like a split screen kind of thing of Tim Scott. He authored a bill in the Senate resolution about anti-Semitism, and he's being opposed by Bernie Sanders. So it hasn't been passed into law yet, but it's very dangerous. And Mike Lawler, who's a Republican for New York, is a leading sponsor of the bill that passed out of the Congress, out of the House of Representatives, said the recent campus protests made passing the measure urgent. So this is the point that I'm trying to drive home is you get book bans. Now they're coming after you, free speech, and now it's so pressing in terms of anti-Semitism. Why wasn't it pressing when Donald Trump said there are good people on both sides with Charlottesville, when you had people with their little tiki lamps marching on campus saying the Jews will not replace us? Was that not anti-Semitism? But no, now when people are speaking up against the genocide that Israel is perpetrating, now anti-Semitism is the problem. In a statement following passage, Lawler said the bill is a key step in calling out anti-Semitism where it is and ensuring anti-Semitic hate crimes on college campuses are properly investigated and prosecuted. He added, when people engage in harassment or bullying of Jewish individuals where they justify the killing of Jews or use blood libel or hold Jews collectively responsible for the actions of the Israeli government, that is anti-Semitic. It's unfortunate that needs to be clarified. That's why this bill is necessary. And as I started out, the organization that put together this language in its opening statement says it's non-legally binding, the language. These were just general guidelines they're giving to educate people in terms of the ills of anti-Semitism. Now, these Republican legislators have seized on that to try and interject that in the current political climate. And I think that as Muslims, we need to be aware of there's already in Title VI the claim of how universities should proceed to investigate cases of discrimination. And I just don't see the need to put this in there as law to try and give or chill the speech of criticism of individuals of the Israeli government. And I think that that's what's under it. And this Mike Lawler, just to give you more information on Mr. Lawler, let me see. There is information, but it only goes back, when we had a sister, Deloria, on, we talked about the five C's. Control was one of them. But we also talked about money being another part of what moves. I'm trying to find. There is a list that if you go to the website, If They Knew, which for years has talked about the reason why the Israeli government is permitted to do what they do is because we as Americans, we don't really understand or know what's being committed in our name. And that's why I really applaud the Jewish forces, the Jewish voices for peace, when they talk about not in our name. And also and Rabbi Shapiro and his congregation and many Jewish congregations that, okay, here we are. Here are the top recipients of APAC, American Israeli Public Affairs Council, those that get top contributions. Although I don't see him on this list, because this list just went, I think, to February or March of 2024. But I did see and I think I mentioned it before, a thing on Cory Booker. He spoke someplace and it said he had received over 780-something thousand from APAC. And so he was being kind of mealy-mouthed about what was going on. Sister Cheryl, your friend Mr. Torres from the Bronx, I believe, he has received $597,618 from APAC. That's just from APAC.
How much is that?
George.
How much?
$597,618. This
That's
is,
why we trade. People
this
trade.
This is through March 31st. This is from January 1st, 2023 to March 31st, 2024. And these are donations made by AIPAC, the Political Action Committee, to federal candidates, party organizations, and PACs from January 1, 2023 to March 31, 2024. George Latimer for Congress, $1,317,454. Rosen for Nevada, $1,147,275. Menendez for Senate out in New Jersey, currently in, under indictment and went to trial today for corruption, Democrat, $1,087,981. Jeffries for Congress, good old brother Hakeem, $770,636. I told you with Torres, he was five on the list. Josh Gottheimer for Congress, $585,675. Let me see some other. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Florida, $399,700. Let me see. I was looking for Mr. Lawler because I saw him on this list. Ted Cruz for Senate, $327,597. Wicker for Senate, $325,721. Okay, Brother Gregory Meeks out of Brooklyn, $320,536. Hey, Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, $311,031. Florida, Mario Diaz-Balart for Congress, $303,175. Let me see. Jake Auchincloss for Congress. I saw him on talking about anti-Semitism a little while ago. $272,118. Scalise, okay, second man in the House. Scalise for Congress, $245,363. And don't forget dear old Rick Scott of Florida, $238,128. Okay, North Carolina, Brother Fleming, Don Davis for North Carolina, $237,753. So.
They have Kathy Manning listed.
Kathy Manning for Congress, $225,023. Let me see.
You raised a lot more than that.
Yeah, because this is just until the end of March. And remember, this is just from AIPAC. This isn't what comes from other people. I don't see him, but I thought I saw him earlier for I must have seen him on another list. Jared Moskowitz for Congress, $110,274. Oh, here's Lawler. Lawler is number 68 on the list. Lawler for Congress, $107,062. So his support of the bill only cost AIPAC $107,062 to sponsor that bill. And Dan Goldman, he's another one. $98,273. Okay. So anyway, this is an interesting list. I would encourage people to go to the website for If Americans Knew, and this is from the Israel-Palestine News and Analysis for from diverse sources. And this is information that was reposted from Sludge Publication. and it was the most complete up-to-date view of APAC PAC donations to congressional candidates. And it was by Donald Shaw, and it posted on May 2nd, 2024. So it was important for people. We talked about when Sister Delaria was on, and Sister Delaria is on that Muslim Coalition. The five C's: community, connection, cash, control, collective action. So we have to be aware of this. And when you get, I wanted to mention this other thing that I saw. It was another publication. And I think people may have seen this posted on social media. This brother Master Bayoun, I think is his name, running for the Senate in Michigan. He was the second that came forth. The first person was Hill Harper, said he was promised $20 million from APAC, a supporter of APAC, to his campaign to run against Rashida Tlaib. He declined. And the second person that came forward, this brother Nasser Bayoun, he was offered $20 million also directly from a representative of APAC. And so these people are not playing. They are serious about trying to get the people, progressives, and those who oppose what's going on in the Israeli government and the effect that they have on our political organization representatives at the federal, but we have to realize this is also at the state level also, because you have ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council, that put together this template that has circulated, I think it's over 26 states, maybe in the 30s by now, who have adopted legislation that people who advocate for the divestment from Israel, that they would not get state contracts, and that applies to educators who may be on state contracts, specialists. There was a speech therapist in Texas, a woman who had been a speech therapist, very high performance in her evaluation. She had been doing it at least 7 years, maybe more. And when she didn't receive, when she refused to sign that statement that she would not advocate for divestment, she was not permitted to come back to work for one of the public school districts in Texas. And you had the independent newspaper publisher in Missouri. Same thing happened to him when he would not sign that statement. He lost state contracts for advertising in his independent newspaper, and he has taken that to the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think we've had a judgment on that yet. But I'm just bringing up all of these incidents of the movement that is strong to prevent American citizens from utilizing our First Amendment right of freedom of speech and also journalistic publications also. So I think it's important for us to realize this. And we ask the question of, well, what can we do? We have to support organizations that fight back against this kind of legislation. Like you were saying, Brother Fleming, with the U.S. CMO, the MOU that you have in terms of legislation, we have to start to really craft and establish a relationship with legislators that the things that reflect our interests, has to be included in legislation, but more importantly, the things that protect the rights of all U.S. citizens is the legislation that we should be supporting. Not, you know, these narrow interests that try to chill the freedoms that we have because, I feel intimidated. I feel harassed. You're anti-Semitic because you're speaking out against Israel. No, I think we have to get legislators in there that have a broader view and who are not bought off and paid by these advocacy groups. And so I'm encouraging everyone to, we talked about what can we do. We can support those Muslim organizations that are standing up for our interests. And also when we get a request to support people like Presley and Omar and Rashida Tlaib and Bowman and Summer Lee and Cori Bush and people who, and Bernie Sanders even, who need the financial support, that cash from grassroots people, we may never be able to out-fundraise the big corporations that they were talking on television this week about. Donald Trump had a meeting and he told oil company corporation leaders, okay, you know, commit that $1 billion to my campaign and we're going to roll back those restrictions that the Biden administration has brought in. He's so bold, out and out grifting. In other words, you pay my legal bills and you don't have to worry about, and get me elected, and you don't have to worry about saving the earth and restrictions on oil products. No, I'll roll all of those restrictions back. Just, hand over the cash. And so we, as Muslims, we're going to have to talk not only with our mouth, we're going to have to talk with our pocketbooks too, and then also work hard for campaign reform, because if you're not a rich individual in some of these swing states, the Republicans have candidates. We had a guy, I think they said he lived in Vermont. He was running for position in Pennsylvania. Now, they make citizens who vote have to have a residency requirement, but the person running for the office doesn't have to have that same residency requirement. How crazy and how corrupt is that? And so you have at least five or six super uber wealthy Republicans who are running for offices in key states so that they can bring back the Twitter in Chief's administration. So we're going to have to, I would suggest, it might be $5, $10, $25, whatever it is, support those representatives who have a record of being sensible and supporting interests that we have, and also the organizations like CARE who need our support, ACGG, Engage, Mosque Cares. There's a new organization that we're aware of, the Black Muslim Leadership Conference, that is involved in political organizing. And we're going to have to, and Sister Dr. Saeed's organization, the Muslim Civic Coalition.org, you know, we're going to have to support these organizations that are working for us and working importantly to educate us about what is going on in the political and the civic arena. And I've taken up so much time, I apologize to Fleming and Cheryl. I know you have much more to say. But I'll turn it over to Brother Fleming, and then Sister Cheryl can take us out. We have about 5 or 6 more minutes. I don't see any hands up from our listeners in the queue. If you have a comment or a question, press 1 on your headset, your handset rather, so that we can recognize you. Brother Fleming, you can get
thank you very much. 30
seconds. You can get 60 seconds. How about that?
Well, thank you very much, sister. I do want to bring one more website to the attention of our listening audience, one that I discovered when I was in D.C. It's called the MuslimCivicCoalition.org. I repeat, MuslimCivicCoalition.org. And they're serious about recording the American Muslim story, including African-American history in America. They've done a fantastic job with their first publication. And so we were leaving this information also to these legislators and senators who may not have the background on our accomplishments in this country. Again, that group is called, or the website is MuslimCivicCoalition.org. And the theme is connect your story with the American Muslim story at MuslimCivicCoalition.org, a very good historical organization. I would encourage our listening audience also to be sure that you vote the whole ballot. Vote the whole ballot. You know, every position on that ballot needs your full attention, not just the presidential elections. You need to vote the whole ballot. Turn it over if you got two sides to it. Vote the whole ballot. Sometimes they wait and put the judges at the very bottom of the ballot. And sometimes some of us see the judge before we see anybody else elected on it, potentially elected official. So be sure to vote the whole ballot and put your voice to it. You know, I've written a couple articles called, you know, the Don't Forget Five, and five meaning the five things we have in the First Amendment to the Constitution. You know, we have freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of peaceful assembly, you know, et cetera. So all five of those are your, you could say, unalienable rights in this country. Don't let anyone deny you any of those opportunities, because as a citizen of this country, you're entitled to those expressions. And this fear thing they're using now is almost like bullying you, telling you can't say certain words. That's an insult to my intelligence. So I hope that you take to heed what we said collectively this afternoon. First, study what's going on. Be informed. Be aware of what they're trying to do in your name without your permission. So you got to be aware of those things and take action with your faith and your conviction to do something about it. I just criticize on the sideline, but take some action to be engaged, to be informed, and to share the information with others who may not be as informed or may not have the interest. But if you have it, you be the catalyst for change and accept that responsibility. So with that, I thank both of my co-hosts this afternoon. I'm glad we had such passion presented to us. A lot of information was shared, and I hope you were listening, because everything that was said is so critical for our successful engagement going forward, and inshallah. Sister Cheryl?
Gracias. Yeah, we've had Dr. Dolores Ayed on, who's one of the founders and executive directors of Muslim Civic Coalition. It used to be the Illinois Muslim Civic Coalition, and now it's gone. So, I will reach out there and have her back. She and I have been coordinating when to get her back on as well. You know, when you visit, if you have a chance, you're in Chicago, go by. Give them greetings. I will just say that we've done a lot today, and we're going to continue the conversation, but it takes all of us, each of us, to have our part. I don't think you can be interested. We cannot be disinterested in what's going on, not only in our community, but everywhere else. So if you change how you look at things, the things you care about, the things you see will change as well. Thank you guys for joining us. And we look forward to continuing next week on our program. Sister, you want to take it out? Last 30 seconds.
Yes, certainly. I just want to remind people that on June 8th, there will be a program celebrating the legacy of our dear brother Abu Qadir al-Amin, who has transitioned. And then the September 8th to the San Francisco Muslim Community Center website to find out more information. And then on September 29th, The Coalition for Human Dignity is sponsoring in L.A. a hero tribute for Naeem Shah Sr. That will be Saturday, June 29th at 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. by the Coalition to Preserve Human Dignity, a tribute to what he has done over the past 50 years, and that's at Southwest College Campus Theater. And don't forget to support independent education with the 150 campaign by Brother Adam Biak. Thank you, and join us and pass the word on to others to join our broadcast as we bring more information encouraging putting faith into action through political and civic engagement. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. That is peace be upon you.